Hi, welcome to Visual Studio Toolbox. I'm your host, Robert Green, and joining me today is Miguel Castro. Hey, Miguel.
How you doing, Rob?
Good. Miguel is an MVP, author, speaker, trainer.
All-around great guy.
Well, so they say. And Miguel is here for the VS Live conference on the Microsoft campus.
Yep.
And therefore, it's a half a five-minute walk from there to here. And
faster than I thought.
Yeah.
I left a half an hour early thinking I was going to get lost. But
I told you it was less than 10-minute walk.
Yeah, but you know what?
I was accounting for people that walk slowly.
Yeah, but this campus is huge and can be a little intimidating for those that don't know their way around. But the signs are laid out beautifully. So you can land in one area and go to another part of town and just follow the signs on the road and that's it.
Cool. And so here we are. And what we're going to do is we're not going to show code. We are just going to chat. And we are going to chat about how you approach new technologies. So as we all know, stuff is constantly being invented, and the stuff that you learned and were expert in a few years ago may or may not have been replaced, may or may not have been superseded, but there's new things coming along.
Sure.
And specifically, you know, one that's near and dear to my heart is WCF. Mm. You know, I learned WCF, I wrote course around WCF, I've been doing WCF for quite some time, but now it seems, maybe I should be doing Web API, right? So how do I know?
And you seem wrong.
Don't give away the conclusion. another good example is WebForms.
Yeah.
Last time anybody checked, WebForms still in the product, still being enhanced.
Absolutely.
But then there's MVC. And so, you know, if you're a WebForm developer, should you stop doing that? Should you start doing MVC? JavaScript frameworks, knockout in Angular, that's another one.
Absolutely.
So you've given away the conclusion. But we're not done.
Well, but that's
so
actually
So how do you as a developer, as a manager, as somebody in the industry, approach the fact that there are continuously more than one way of doing what appears to be exactly the same thing, and new ones keep getting invented?
There's no easy answer to that, shy of be prepared to just lose a lot more sleep. And I don't mean that as in be more nervous. I mean that in literally lose a lot more sleep hours because you just need more time in the day. The first thing I think you got to do, at least in my case, is accept and understand that a lot of these technologies are not replacements for the other. And when they're not replacements for the other, you don't need necessarily to go rush out and dump the old one and learn the new one. In fact, the term old and new are almost misnomers there. As in the case with WCF and Web API, that's one of the quintessential examples of what we're talking about here. I get this all the time. A large part of the development community misinterprets Microsoft's lack of discussion on something with the death of something.
Mm-hmm.
And those two things are drastically different concepts. WCF, a technology like WCF, is by no means dead.
There's also a confusion with the lack of constant innovation with the death of something.
Things absolutely
become mature. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's anything wrong with them or they don't
work. No, on the contrary,
that
can be
them exclusively.
If you want to put a positive spin on that, it's done. They can't make it any better. WCF does what it does, and it does it very, very well. Mm-hmm. It does SOAP behind the firewall SOAP services with very rich functionality, things like callbacks and instantiation and concurrency and transaction handling, all of those things. It does it really, really well. And if you're developing applications where your services are behind the firewall, it's still a fantastic technology. And it's a technology that I use primarily for that. Now, notice I said behind the firewall, right? Okay, so that gets a little weird there because originally, Microsoft was touting this technology as it's very interoperable and you can cross the firewall. Just change the binding and you're outside the firewall. You can do it, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Technologically speaking, you can change the binding to be HTTP and you can cross the firewall. And then you can also do what Microsoft says you can do, which is have non-.NET clients read the service. Where it falls a little short, and this is where Web API started to gain a lot of popularity, is in that area of true outside firewall interoperability. Yep. WCF is a SOAP-based technology. Like it or not, it's a SOAP-based technology. SOAP requires tooling. And without tooling, you can have a really, really hard time.
Right.
Because to read a message that comes across the wire without SOAP tooling is just a major pain in the butt.
By tooling, you mean runtime as well as as well as design time.
Both,
right?
Absolutely, yeah. Because you have to be
and
able
to... You have to have runtimes on the receiving end, yep, that know what to do with a SOAP message.
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely. And a SOAP message is a very heavy message. Make no mistake about that. Even the smallest SOAP message carries a body with an envelope.
All you got to do is look at WSDL, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Which is this much.
Exactly.
There's a method, there's a method, there's a method, but it's this long.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. So if you have this tooling, then fine. But if you don't, it becomes a real headache. And Web API eliminates a lot of that headache. Mm-hmm. Now, here's where I think a lot of people are wrong. Web API does not eliminate a lot of code. And I'll explain why. Web API eliminates the headache because your message is very lightweight. Your message is very, very simple. It's easy to read by the human eye. If you and your brain can take a REST message apart, a JSON or XML, let's not get into the whole REST, because you know REST is architecture, SOAP's a protocol, so right, not really versus there. But if you can take a JSON or XML message apart with your eye and have your brain make heads or tails of it in a second, that simplicity alone has, mm-hmm, has a lot of attractiveness. And it's because of that simplicity carried through an HTTP line, which is cross-firewall compatible, that makes a technology like Web API or other REST-based server technologies very, very popular. Now, mm-hmm, as far as code savings is concerned, I don't think there's code savings at all. This is where I get into arguments with developers that are .NET developers. They don't require interoperability. They don't require iPhone or Android access to a service. All they require is desktop access or website access. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, you're still talking about an intranet application because your web server's behind your firewall, right? Your browser's the dumb animal on the outside. So if you're doing that and you want to go Web API like some of my peers have done, you're not saving a whole lot of code. You still need to write the service. You need to do that on both the Web API and WCF. Mm-hmm. You still need something to host it. Sure, in WCF, you have to write your own host. In Web API, you got the host built in if you're doing a website. If you're not doing a website, then you need a host. Your host now needs to be a website, or it can be self-hosted or using right. OWEN now. So you still need the service. You still need the host. The other argument that I get when having this conversation is, yeah, but I don't need contracts. I don't need to write any contracts. Okay, I'll give you that you don't need to write any service contracts. You don't need to describe your service API. Do you need to write any data contracts? No, of course I don't. Mm-hmm. Well, sure you do. You need to write data models.
Right.
I mean, something's going to have to be returned to the outside world and then let Web API serialize it in the JSON. That has to start out as a C# object. If your client is going to be .NET, now you need to deal with the HTTP client class and learn how to use that.
Right.
You can wrap that in a class and say, okay, now I got a simple class to access my service. And what have you just done? You've done what you have to do in WCF, which is write a proxy class. So all these elements haven't gone away. They've just taken a different form. And maybe some have gotten simpler, some have gotten less simple. I personally think that a proxy class is extremely easy to write. If I'm going to have a manual client class to access a Web API service, wrapping all the HTTP client stuff is actually much more complicated, mm-hmm, than writing a simple proxy class. So then when we start isolating all these elements, the only thing we're talking about that we don't need in Web API are service contracts. And that's one item, right, one element.
Yep.
And to me, the explicitness of the contract declaration has a lot of value. So I don't consider that a negative, that you don't need that in Web API.
Okay.
I consider that contract a positive in the WCF side.
So would you then say that the decision of what to use when is completely based on scenario?
I think
if
it's
you're
100%
building behind
scenario.
The firewall, whether it's a WPF or Win8 or ASP app,
yeah,
you're behind the firewall, you can continue to use WCF if that's what you know, and you can completely get your job done, and that's just fine.
I think so, and that's still, mm-hmm, what I do, and most systems that I design for clients use a combination of both.
Okay.
To me, like I said, most systems, you know, I am a Microsoft guy, I'm a .NET guy, and when I go into a client, it's typically because they're a Microsoft shop. I mean, it has happened where they're not, but 99% of the time, they're a Microsoft shop. So my world usually starts, if I'm doing service orientation, my world usually starts in the WCF side of things. And they're, you know, my clients are writing applications that are hitting their services, either
right,
from a desktop app or from a web app. Then we get to a point as the application progresses where mobility needs to come into,
yep,
the picture. Now, if mobility needs to be dissimilar platforms like iPhone or Android, obviously WCF's not going to work there. So what am I going to do? I'm going to extend the range of my services with a web API layer.
Well, before we get there, let's say that it's not dissimilar. It's Windows 8.1, Windows Phone 1, you write it as a universal app.
Which has system.service model, if I'm not mistaken. I don't want to be quoted on that. I'm not 100% sure.
So, actually, Phone 8.1 doesn't have WCF. So Windows Phone 8 using the Silverlight runtime, which still supports WCF.
Okay.
So, but people are going to be accessing it outside the firewall. Would you set up the service using WCF or web API?
I can do it with WCF and just set up a separate binding. Why am I going to add more code? All I got to add is another 3 or 4 lines of configuration.
Okay. Now, there are certain things that appear to be much easier in web API than WCF. A lot of the work that has been going on with authenticating using Azure Active Directory, a lot of the stuff that our good friend Vittorio has been doing.
Security's always the wrench in everything,
works,
isn't it?
Works with WCF, but it seems to be way easier with web API.
It is. And security's always a complex thing. It's a hard thing to defend because I know WCF security. As a matter of fact, I can't claim to know 100% of WCF security. WCF has such an elaborate security model that you can do 100 different things that I have never done. I've had a certain number of scenarios that I know how to attack. I know how to do it, so it's not complex to me. And I've taught it for many years. So it's not difficult for me to do X509 certificate usage in an internet scenario or just regular transport security in an intranet scenario. For those that don't know how to do it, especially once you introduce the concepts of certificates, it can get really hairy. And certificates usage seems to be one of those things that you can get your scripts and your code down perfectly, and depending on the tides and the phase of the moon, they just won't work. You know, it's very easy to overlook a little detail that'll have you debugging for an hour. In that area, I can definitely see how they say web API security is easier, especially with the introduction of Azure.
Right. Okay, so let's say you know WCF, and you're going to write an app. You're going to put data in the cloud. You're going to put services in the cloud. And you've got mobile clients. Could be all Windows. Could be Windows, iOS, and Android. Mm-hmm. And so you decide that you really should go over to web API. What approach would you recommend taking to learn something that's brand new, and especially for someone that maybe isn't a web developer? So this is ASP.NET, right? So it's written by the ASP.NET team, so it's web, but I don't do web. I do all client stuff.
Well, I mean, you can't leverage all your desktop capabilities and dish out a web application. Obviously, if you're not a web developer, then you need to get somebody who is, or get a team together that can do it. I'm not sure if that's what you're asking.
So let me rephrase. So if I'm a client developer and I look at something like web API, my initial reaction could be potentially, oh, this is coming from the web guys. It's written by the ASP.NET team. I don't do ASP.NET. How do I?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
If I do web API, do I got to learn all that ASP.NET stuff that I haven't had to learn?
No, you don't. Just because web API claims to be simpler than WCF doesn't mean you can ignore the world around it 100%. Mm-hmm. Web API claims to, instead of abstract the transport, it embraces the transport, unlike WCF that abstracts it. So I think that you don't need to learn the web, but to do successful web API, well-written web API development, I think you have to have a certain amount of knowledge about the HTTP stack. You have to understand verbs and content headers and things like that, and you have to understand a request and a response message and how they work and how they look. I don't think you can get around that. If you really want to abstract all that knowledge and say, the heck with this, I just want to concentrate on my C#, at this point, you're probably even closer to the WCF side of things, which is very good at abstracting everything. Not to say that you can do it without learning WCF, but you understand that both technologies do have something you got to learn.
Right.
As far as what you said about somebody looking at it from the side of, well, this is coming from the web team. I'm not a web guy, so I'm not going to use it. I'm going to use this. I think that they just have to be better educated. Just because something came out of the web team, I mean, we all know the web API has had a pretty funny history. how it's traveled around the teams in Microsoft. And just because it finally found a home in the ASP.NET side of things doesn't mean that it's a web product that, unless you're a web developer, you can't use it. It's just, you know, Microsoft's Web API is Microsoft's implementation of REST-based services.
Right.
And those are best served by the ASP.NET framework because it's such a good framework. So their home in ASP.NET just makes sense. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make it just a web-only technology. And those that think that it may be just need to be educated
a little
more.
So what would be your advice for somebody that was a WCF developer who wanted to start learning and get good at Web API? How would you go about learning it?
Well, there's a lot of great courseware online, of course. It's not a difficult technology to get up to speed on.
Okay.
To be honest with you, something to a good developer, creating a Web API project using the Visual Studio templates and just looking at the code that it creates for you, mm-hmm. Though it's not the way I typically like to write Web API, the convention over configuration approach that Microsoft took does work. And it's not very difficult for a new guy to look at it and say, oh, so that's how I write a Web API service. Cool, let me continue.
Okay.
And then learn little details as they go along. It's not something you have to, you know, get super fluent in. As far as writing Web API the correct way, the way I like to deal with request and response messages, this is where I say a little knowledge of the HTTP stack really does go a long way. And you don't have to become an HTTP expert. Mm-hmm. You know, I've never met anybody that knows HTTP better than Eric Lawrence, the guy that wrote Fiddler. I've never met anybody that is at that level of understanding the HTTP stack. I mean,
right.
It can be a complicated stack. But understanding the simple parts of it, like what the primary verbs are and what a request and a response message is and what a header looks like, especially when you get into security, you got to understand what the header looks mm-hmm. like. Those are prerequisites that I think you can learn by just binging stuff online or just reading some white papers and a very thin book. It's simple stuff. And it's enough to get you going. But it's not material that you can skip completely.
Right. Is using Web API as a intermediary between the client and your existing WCF services a valid approach?
Yeah, I do that all the time.
Okay.
Because
certainly for existing services.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. And once again, I'm speaking primarily in my world. But mm-hmm. in my world, I'm designing larger systems for clients, and these large systems, they don't always start with mobility. And even if they do, there's always a desktop and a mobility component. And the mobile component, I think, by the nature of mobile applications alone, are never 100% feature set of the desktop component. They're always
right.
a subset of it. You know, tablet's a subset of desktop. Mobile is a subset of tablet almost.
Mm-hmm.
So the larger element of my world, the larger set of services, are there to serve the desktop or the and/or the website. And that's where I am in the WCF space. And then whatever parts of those sets of services I need to extend beyond the firewall so that a mobile client has access to them, mm-hmm. I then have a Web API layer. The Web API layer becomes the server point of the mobile apps,
yep.
but the client point of the WCF services.
Right.
So it is kind of a middleware component, depending on your point of view. If you're a guy holding a phone in your hand, you have no idea. To you, that's just a server
right, you don't,
end of it.
Right, you don't know, and the beautiful thing is
exactly.
you don't have to care.
Exactly.
You
and
talk to
you
Web API, you make a request, it sends you back data. What
exactly.
do you care how it got it?
Exactly, and you only extend what you need. So
right.
I have a set of 100 different service operations that I'm calling. I don't need all 100 of them for the mobile version of my system.
Right.
I need to extend 20 of them. So I don't have to reinvent the wheel or rewrite them. I don't
yep.
have to rewrite all 100 in Web API. I don't want to rewrite all 100 from the beginning of Web API. I see a lot of people take the lowest common denominator approach, where they're like, well, if I have WCF that can serve this and Web API that can serve just this,
mm-hmm.
or Web API can serve everything, including mobile, why don't I just do everything here? And it depends on what your needs are. Obviously, the answers, it depends for everything, right?
Sure.
WCF will give me, number one, WCF will give me a lot faster access because of its TCP capability, which I don't get with Web API. So why am I going to do my entire system on the HTTP stack when
mm-hmm.
I can benefit from a little more speed? Number two, depending on what my needs are of the application, there's maybe functionality that I'm going to need that WCF will provide for me. Now, that doesn't mean that Web API doesn't have any of this functionality. It has some of it, but a lot of it requires more work. The first one that I can think of is transaction programming.
Yeah.
When I'm doing transactions in Web API, I have to understand the transaction scope model and how that works, system that transactions namespace. In WCF, I just need to understand how the declarative model works, what to decorate with what, and what those things mean. Mm-hmm. You still got to learn that, obviously, but the coding model is a little differently, and it's a little simpler. Same thing for instantiation. Web API is inherently stateless. Why is that? Right. Because of its embracement of HTTP, which is a stateless protocol. WCF can be stateless, can mm-hmm. be stateful, because it has different modes of instantiation. And for anybody that's out there that says, well, we've never used this before, I don't need it, I have. Maybe you haven't. I'm not saying that everybody's going to need it. But I have written per call and per session services. Singleton, not so much. But per call and per session services, where I've really, really benefited from the idea that this service is still alive and maintaining state for me.
Okay.
And we do not have that in Web API. Can you maintain state in Web API? Absolutely. You just got to come up with your own facility for it.
Right.
Whereas WCF will take care of it. Concurrency is another issue. Those kind of things. Callbacks. Some will argue, of course, that with Web API, you can do callbacks with SignalR now, which you certainly can.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different programming model. I'm not here to argue which one is better, because right. I'm not well-versed enough in SignalR to tell you it's easier or harder. But I'm very well-versed in the way the callbacks work in WCF, and they work really, really nice, and I use them extensively.
Right. So to close on this issue, the idea is that if you're behind the firewall, there's no reason not to continue to use WCF.
Sure.
If you run into scenarios or need to use Web API, certainly learn it, get good at it, and then choose which one makes the most sense.
Absolutely.
If you're in a situation,
be prepared to use both.
Yeah, and I really like the idea of doing the Web API interface to the WCF service.
Sure.
You have an enterprise app people are accessing on their phone, and they need to authenticate against Azure AD. Mm-hmm. Active Directory, and you decide it's way easier to do that in a Web API, and there's lots and lots of documentation, code sure. samples to show you how to do that. So create a Web API whose sole purpose is to do the authentication and then call the existing WCF service.
You can.
Right?
You can.
You can?
Certainly do.
Is there anything wrong with that?
I don't think so.
Is that
I don't think so. I could already hear.
Cheating?
I could
that
already,
sound cheap and
no,
cheating?
But you know, you're using whatever tools at your disposal to get the job done. You're using the right tool for the right job,
right.
which is a philosophy that I've been preaching since the beginning of time. You're not squeezing one into the other.
Right.
You've used one tool as much as you can. You found out a little shortcoming where you can mm-hmm. accomplish something easier, but something here is here to assist you.
Yeah, you're getting the job done, and
absolutely.
Remember, shipping is a feature too, right?
And that's the thing. At the end of the day, remember, I'm a consultant, so every problem that I approach from a very client-oriented way, just because those are the guys that pay my bills.
Yeah.
Your client does not care. I mean, right. Your client's development team will hopefully want good practices, good architecture, good standards set around. But your client at the end of the day needs the product shipped.
Right.
And you know, if it's going to take you an extra week to do something when you can get it done by introducing another library, another yep. technology in less than a day, I would say take that approach.
Absolutely. All right, let's shift gears and talk about web forms and MVC.
Oh, I love them both.
Okay.
I love them both.
So we'll state that web forms have been out there for a long time.
Yep.
Web forms are continuing to evolve.
Yep.
The ASP team has moved sort of to this one ASP.NET approach.
Yep.
Basically, in 2013, you create an ASP.NET project.
I'll be speaking about it tomorrow.
And you can use web forms pieces. You can use MVC pieces. So they've done quite a bit of great work to eliminate this artificial silo that we had.
Absolutely.
But let's say you're a web form developer, and you're kind of wondering what's going on.
Okay, so my first, this is conversations I have with my customers all the time.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing I want to say on that is that, and I'm going to get yelled at when I get back in the speaker's room, but MVC is not a replacement for web forms, number one.
So it's there are speakers here at at this show who will yell at you about that?
Oh God, yes.
Oh, maybe we should do a. Maybe we should do a show.
Well,
where
we can do
you
a SmackDown.
Yell at each other.
We can do a SmackDown, and it would be a lot of fun because we're all good friends. But, right. But a lot of things we disagree wholeheartedly on.
Okay.
NBC is not number one. NBC is not a replacement for web forms. It's an alternative. The number one thing I tell customers when they say, which direction should I go? There's a couple of things that go into this decision. The first one is, tell me about your current team and where your current skill set is. Mm-hmm. Both technologies are pretty different. I think, first of all, let me say, I think it's a real tribute to ASP.NET's architecture as mm-hmm. a request response management system that both of these products were written on top of it.
Right.
I think it was brilliant the way that was done. I mean, hell, even WCF service hosting is written on top of ASP.NET, which works yep. very nicely. But where your current skill set in is very relevant, and where your current financial investment is very relevant, because WebForms' number one selling point, number one programming model, is its web control architecture, its yeah. web control approach of doing things, which funny enough, it was designed to make Windows developers feel warm and fuzzy
yes.
in the web world.
That's you right. know,
drag and drop, rad development. And I hate the term rad because it today has a very negative connotation. When people say you're a rad developer, it's like, oh, you must use VB or something like that. And there's another argument, right? VB and C Sharp.
We're not going to have that.
We're one. Not. And I'll be on the record as saying I love VB. It's a fantastic language. But where your current investment is, what I mean by that is that a lot of companies have invested in third-party controls. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, web forms has a huge benefit with the control model. And the control model has evolved to accommodate a changing web world. Today, we're very much into the JavaScript, keep things in the client, mm-hmm. less postback type of thing. And a lot of the control vendors out there, especially the larger control vendors, have been evolving their products so that the controls that they render are more client-side savvy and client-side friendly. Remember, all a web control is the rendering of output.
Right.
That output doesn't have to be HTML. It can be JavaScript. It can be anything.
Sure.
You can write a web control that renders out an entire Angular view model if you want. It's definitely doable. So if I run into a company that has a tremendous financial investment, when I say tremendous, let's say they have 30, 35 developers, and they have 30, 35 licenses of a DevExpress component, for mm-hmm. example, that's a serious investment. And telling them to drop web forms and do everything in MVC may be fine and dandy in some people's eyes, but now I have to explain to this company why they're not going to be able to leverage the $40,000 or $50,000 worth of investment that they have into these control suites.
Right.
That I might have been the one to advise them on that 3 years earlier. You see what I mean? So your current skill set is very relevant. If your skill set is in the web forms world, if you're used to doing things, and I'm not going to use the term drag and drop because even in web forms, I still code in the ASPX
right.
page. I don't do drag and drop. But if your skill set is in writing web forms using a web control model, I honestly don't have a problem telling them to continue to do that. You can still leverage a lot of new stuff that they've added. I mean, they've added the model binder to WebForms 4 now, so you can bind things at the view level, mm-hmm. Where before, binding was very, very control specific,
right?
The grid view bound one way, the data repeater, the repeater did another way, and everything control was very different.
Yep.
Now it's a little broader. It's become more and more industry standard as far as binding standards are concerned. You can also you also need to another conversation that I have to have with clients is okay, now that we've established that your skill set is in the web form world, your developers are fully trained there.
Mm-hmm.
I usually would tell them stay in that direction simply because it's a loss in their previous investment and it's another expense of training their developers in
right.
the MVC spaces. But the next question is, okay, tell me about this application and how real, let me not use the term real world, how state of the art in today's web standards do we want to make it? Today, rich UI on the client in the web is the entire craze.
Mm-hmm.
It's why Knockout took off. It's why Angular has taken off. Everything is about staying on the client.
Right.
And MVC to me, now I'm once again I'm probably going to get yelled at, especially by guys at Microsoft, but I write everything now in, I know both platforms very well. So I usually go the MVC route, primarily because I usually have a binding library at my disposal, either Knockout or Angular, and we'll get into that discussion.
Okay.
I don't use MVC in its conventional fashion anymore, even for the smallest apps. I don't take an entire view, generate it with HTML helpers based on data annotations, and then post it back to the controller that served that view that's marked with a post. I don't do that anymore because I need more rich UI experiences for my customers. So because of that, my usage of MVC features is really limited to the delivery of views, the layout, and that's really about it. And from there, a lot of JavaScript takes over. A lot of JavaScript libraries take over.
Okay.
This is something I can do equally well in web forms without using web control. So at that point, the product, ASP MVC or ASP Web Forms, to me becomes more of a delivery mechanism for views that are going to then do a lot of stuff with JavaScript libraries, the topic of our next conversation.
Yep.
So if the client likes that idea and that's the kind of site they want to decide, at that point, I would probably then steer them on the MVC route because I don't have to train them in 100% of MVC, just the delivery side of it, which is a lot simpler. And to me, that's probably a little simpler than web forms, because I think when you stop using a lot of the posting features and stuff that MVC has, you lose very little. When you stop using the web control model of web forms, you lose a lot.
Okay.
At that point, you're really not taking advantage of the big strength of web forms. And if you're not going to, I don't see a reason to advise on it. You know what I mean?
Yep.
At that point, I just want to keep my clients one step above raw HTML. And that is give them a good framework for managing their code and for delivering views.
Okay.
And that's where I think MVC rocks a little more there.
Okay. Good. Third and final topic is Knockout and Angular.
Oh, boy. That's
and this one.
I love that one.
This one's interesting. It's very interesting in the JavaScript world. Lots and lots of innovation, new frameworks coming out all the time. I've heard people, you know, say that that's the biggest problem with JavaScript development is how do you bank on something that you know will be around for a while?
You get bombarded with frameworks.
Mm-hmm. You choose something like, you know, technologies that we make that, you know, even if we de-invest in them, they kind of mature, they stick around. You can pick up something like that. You can pick up MVC and know that it's going to be around for quite some time.
Sure.
There's a feeling among folks that the JavaScript frameworks don't quite have that stability, that you might jump on today's bandwagon and it turns out that a year from now nobody is doing it, or even 6 months from now.
I think
is that overstated?
No, it's not. But I think that you need to I need to start out by countering that by saying it depends on who the source of the library is.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you get into these two libraries that we started the discussion with, Knockout and Angular, where they're rooted, where they come from is very relevant. And I think that should definitely alleviate any nervousness towards will they be around.
Okay.
Knockout comes from Microsoft. Well, I mean, it obviously came from Steve, but it's, you know, it's considered a Microsoft product almost because it's shipped with the MVC templates. With the one ASP.NET templates.
Right.
Because it's shipped with web forms as well now too. Angular, as we all know, comes from Google. I don't think either company is in danger of going away anytime soon. The other libraries, I mean, there's tons of libraries out there, and you know, you gotta with something as important as binding and dependency injection and routing, which are all the features that Angular has, you tend to really want to depend on good backing behind it, which is why Angular is considered to be so solid, because it comes from Google, and Google's not going to die anytime soon.
Right.
But then there's other libraries out there, little helper libraries that you just don't know where they're coming from. At that point, it really becomes some people would say crapshoot, I'll say judgment call. There's a library, for example. Can I mention library names?
Of course.
Okay, so there's an open source library. I honestly don't know who wrote this library, and I apologize to the gentleman if he happens to be listening. There's a great library for date manipulation. It's called Moment, Moment.js. Mm-hmm. Yep. And it has just a plethora of API to manipulate dates and reformat dates and all sorts of things.
If you create an MVC project, I believe Moment is used in it.
Modernizer is.
Oh, all right.
If you're looking for another M word.
I've seen it.
But it's available from NuGet. It's written by I don't remember. To be honest with you, I don't remember what the guy's name is. So I do apologize for that. But it's a great library. And should I be concerned? Oh, I don't want to use this because it's a one guy thing, and mm-hmm. I don't know if he's going to be around. You know, to be honest with you, I don't care. The library does what it does very, very well. And I got the source code, and I have no problem recommending it to clients and telling you to use this.
Okay.
It does what it does. If you encounter a bug, well, you could either try to debug it yourself or send the guy an email. Sure, that's the crapshoot part of it. But why am I going to shy away from it just because it didn't come from Google or Yahoo or Microsoft mm-hmm. or Apple? You know, some of the best contributions in these libraries are from guys like you that just write something and put it out there. You know.
Right.
Some of it rides on the coattail of larger products. An example of this is Eric Bachtel's KO validation library, which is validation for knockout. But it doesn't make it bad. It's just it's a great little library. It does exactly what it does. And mm-hmm. I have clients using KO validation right now. Are they concerned that Eric's going to get hit by a bus and not do anything with that library? Well, first of all, the library has three people behind it, so if Eric gets hit by a bus, there's two other guys.
Well, that would be very sad.
Of course. And I'm sorry, Eric. And I don't know Eric personally, so if he is watching, he's hopefully laughing. It really doesn't matter to me. It's one of those things where the library does what it does really well, mm-hmm. and if something doesn't work with it, I'm pretty confident I can find a way around it. Unlike something larger, like Angular, where if the dependency injection part of it starts failing or mm-hmm. Bugs are in there, I'm not going to go in there and debug this thing myself.
Right.
I want more good backing on something so important, so large. So the fact that comes from Google is important to me. So like I said, the size of the library and what its usage is and where it comes from, I think, are two things that are very intertwined there and need to take part of the decision. Okay. Now, one of the, and believe me, if anybody's ever looked at the Angular code, there is comments in the Angular source code that literally say, warning, insanity level code here. Hmm. Seriously, there are comments. So there is some crazy stuff in there that you just don't want to get into. I did a knockout talk today, and one of the first things that I always have to talk about is knockout versus Angular.
Right.
That's becoming as much of an age-old battle, even though it's a new battle, as VB versus C#, ASP Web Forms versus MVC, mm-hmm. and of course WCF versus Web API. So we've covered all of the major world crises events here. Okay, we can get into Middle East later if you like. Or you can edit that out. I anticipated the question today, and this is the first time that I've given this talk where I anticipated it and I started talking about this battle before somebody even asked it. And I knew I was successful because I get up on stage and I start talking about, okay, so we're here to talk about knockout, and I immediately get a couple of hands that go up. And I said, but I want to start by talking about this, and the hands go down. Right. And then they don't raise them up anymore. The first thing you got to do is understand what the two products are and how they're not really competing products. Angular is a full-blown framework. Angular offers three primary things. Now, I say primary because it offers other things too, but three primary things. It offers binding, it offers dependency injection, and it offers routing. All three are very important if you're going to write a single-page app. Now, when I say single-page app, I just want to digress for a second and make sure that people understand that single-page app, the A in SPA, is it should not be there. In my opinion, a website should not be one single page, end of story, and everything is on that page.
Okay.
That just becomes a code management nightmare, in my opinion. Not even Google's Gmail is like that. Even Google's Gmail is made up of what I like to call, and I'm not going to lay claim to this term, this is Brian Noyes that coined the term SPA silos of mm-hmm. SPA. I call it pockets of SPA, same exact thing, where you have different parts of the site where a view gets rendered from the service, from the server, and while you're there, you're in SPA mode. Okay. Even Gmail is like this, or Hotmail, where while you're in the mail screen, you're in an SPA mode, but right. if you go to settings and go to somewhere else, it goes, gets another page from the server and right. feeds you another view. So if you're going to do something that has a lot of SPA work that requires the ability to switch around client-delivered views, but then also have back button functionality to go back to them, in other words, track routing history, if you want code manageability for dependency injection, if you want the ability to break your app out into reusable JavaScript services that can get injected into your different view models, you need all these three things. I think Angular is a fantastic product. It really, really is. And it is what I use today, what I recommend today. But there's a lot of times where that's not necessary. Remember where I made the comment that I don't use conventional MDC anymore? Mm-hmm. Even if I'm going to write a simple application that shows me a grid of information, click edit on a grid item, show a form, edit the information, post it, save it, back to the grid.
Right.
I can write that in an hour, right? Even something like that, I don't do it the MVC route because to me it's now easier to use something like Knockout. I also don't need something like Angular, which is more complex to use, okay. it is more complex to learn, and it has a lot of things that that particular application just doesn't need. Knockout is a binding library only, and it does what it does really, really well. So the reason I say they're not competitors is because even though Angular has got binding, if all my if I want to stay more towards the conventional MVC, but add the beauty of client-side binding to my views, but still have different views everywhere where I get a different view for every click that I do. Within that view, I want to be able to get and load data dynamically and view it dynamically. That's typically my usage for Knockout today. And this is the conversation I had with my audience today. This is the way I try to sell the technology. I can no longer sell Knockout as this is the binding you should use instead of Angular. It doesn't work that way because Angular has just become way too powerful, way okay. too... Even Microsoft has embraced Angular. You know, so that, of course, puts a big question mark in a lot of conference attendees' head. Well, if Microsoft's doing this, what's Angular good for? Well, Angular, what's Knockout good for? Right. Knockout is given to you automatically when you create a new MVC project. It's there. Mm-hmm. So the way I sell it today and the way I use it today is it's there to assist me in my otherwise conventional MVC applications. The minute I go to one step further and write a full-blown site that has these well-designed pockets of SPA and has a lot of code and I need to benefit from code reusability and injection, that's when I tend to go to another framework, and that's where Angular comes okay. in. Knockout used to be in this world too, thanks to Rob Eisenberg, who wrote Durandal. Durandal added these features to Knockout. It used Knockout as the binding component, and then it added DI and testability and routing.
Right.
But unfortunately, and you know, if that's the route you want, if you're a Knockout Durandal shop today, there's really no reason to change. Okay. Durandal, as it stands, the version that works and that is solid is not going anywhere. It's my understanding it's not going anywhere, but what it was going to be turned into with Durandal 2 or something like that, I think has been dropped. Rob's doing work for Angular now, which is okay. kind of ironic.
Yeah.
But he is working with the Google team on Angular, but he has said that he's going to keep the old version out there for those that are already using it. So, you know, technologically speaking, you can compete Knockout/Durandal with Angular, but unfortunately, in the real world, a lot of times we have to kind of follow the direction that the wind goes, and Google is just putting so much resources into improving Angular and making it more than what it already is, that for larger systems with full SPA necessities, that seems to be where we're all headed, and you know, a little reluctantly, I've embraced that as well, but I don't think by no means that Knockout is dead or that it's completely useless.
Okay.
Like I said, I have tons of reasons why I just need immediate binding to spiff up my views. Right. I can take an existing MVC app and add binding to my views. You can't do that with Angular. I mean, you can, but it's a lot more involved.
Right.
You have to add a bunch of other stuff to it around the app, where Knockout can be very, very focused view per view.
Right. So the Uber answer is that, you know, we've been through this before, multiple technologies. Understand what they do, understand what they're good for, their tools, use the best tool for the job.
There's nothing bad whatsoever that comes from increasing the arsenal in your tool belt.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
They're called developer tools for a reason. They're tools. They're things you can use to build things.
Yep.
It's not religion. It's not, it's not, this versus that, and, we duke it out. They're just tools.
Absolutely.
Now, let's not minimize the learning curve of learning new tools, but that's a good thing to do. The more tools you know, the more you're able to respond to specific situations.
Look, because I can't leave without pissing as many people off as I possibly can. In your audience.
Well, I got a bonus topic.
Let me say that any good developer, any good geek is going to thrive, is going to get off on just learning something new and learning as many things as you can. And those are the people I want working with me and for me, more importantly.
Right.
Or should I reverse that? With me, more importantly. If there's a developer that actually is posing this as a serious complaint, well, holy cow, I got to learn this now and I got to learn this. Mm-hmm. I just don't know if that's the kind of developer I want to work with.
Okay.
I mean, at the end of the day, we're geeks. I mean, that's why we're here. That's why we're sitting in this room talking to hopefully other geeks, right?
Yeah.
And most that I know, most people that I know, and despite the arguments I'll get back at the speaker room at BS Live when they watch this, we will all agree on that. There isn't a person in that speaker's room that can't wait to get home and read about this new cool thing. Whether they use it is another story.
Right.
But there's nothing wrong with just learning something, even if it's at a surface level.
Yeah.
Learn enough to remember that it's available to you and learn the details when you feel you need it later.
Cool. All right, bonus topic.
Uh-oh.
American sports cars versus European sports cars.
Well, I have a good old-fashioned American muscle car that'll rival any Lamborghini Gallardo on the market.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, I've come up against them and I've been triumphant. Now, that's not on a racetrack, of course, but I'm just a car nut.
And that's obeying all posted speed limits and driving responsibly, of course.
While thinking on the metric system in America, yes. I'm gonna attack this the same way I attacked the previous topics. Okay, there's not a versus here. If you're a car buff, you'll like both of them. That's like saying I'm a Star Trek fan, but I didn't like Voyager. I never watched it. No, if you're a Star Trek fan, you're gonna watch all of them, man. You may like one more than another.
There you go.
But you're a Star Trek fan. You're a Star Trek fan. Okay. The only battle that you should have is with the Star Wars guys, and now the Lord of the Rings guys. not the other Star Trek guys.
There you go.
Should be one world. Same thing with I'm a total car nut.
Yeah, me too.
One of my favorite all-time sports is just getting reintroduced in America now. I'm a big Formula One fan, and Formula One's not an American sport. It's just getting reintroduced back into America with the building of the track in Austin. So that's mostly a European sport. Doesn't make it bad. I'm not a NASCAR guy, by no means, and that's a total American sport, right? So as far as the hardware is concerned, it's just that.
It's people, guys and gals, who like fast cars and like to drive fast.
Absolutely.
Which is just plain fun.
Absolutely. And we've built some tremendous machines in this country, even in the supercar category. I mean, first of all, you can't dismiss what Tesla's doing with their Model S. I mean, you're talking about a car that's got instant 100% torque right off the line. That'll rival my Mustang. I can take it on a 0-60, but in the quarter mile, we're very, very close.
Yeah.
But there's American supercars. I mean, the Saleen S7, which is 230 mile an hour car. There's one thing that we have in this country regarding sports cars, supercars, that they don't have in Europe, and that is we got third party modifiers.
Right.
Which is not very popular in Europe. What's popular are tuners. So in Europe, there's shops that will take Porsches out of the box, because most Porsche owners, and I know you are one, don't know that Porsches are incredibly conservatively tuned, even in Europe.
Yeah.
And there are shops that specialize in doing nothing more than retuning these cars. In America, we
for
do things
for stupendous amounts of money, typically.
Right, exactly. Well, in America, if you got stupid amount of money, we have a lot more choice, because we got guys like John Hennessy, for example, out of Texas, that will take a Camaro and turn it into a 1,200 horsepower beast.
Right.
We got guys like Callaway that used to do that with Corvettes.
Yep.
We got guys like Shelby and well, the late Carroll Shelby, of course, but the company's still going strong. We got Steve Staline on the Staline side, Jack Roush on the Roush side, that have done tremendous things with Mustangs. And these become off-the-shelf products. I mean, you can go buy an $80,000 Roush Mustang, you know, or $140,000. Hell, the Shelby GT1000 is a $200,000 car.
Yeah.
I mean, that's as expensive as a Ferrari 430.
And it's probably a shorter waiting list, too.
And it's faster. You probably get one. And it's faster. It's actually faster. So there's just so many pluses and minuses to both sides of the car world. That's why I love. And obviously, you've opened up a can of worms because, you know, when it comes, you want to talk about.
I just wanted to spend a few minutes talking about cars. That's all.
Absolutely.
Visual Studio, we're done with that. We're going to
Well, these are two
cars.
Topics that obviously I can just talk hours on.
Me too. All right. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
This is awesome. And we'll see you next time on Visual Studio Toolbox.